The Committee on Capital Investment will come to order. And members who are here, we do have some coffee and right behind us, so please help yourself. This morning we're going to talk about two different areas, Department of Corrections and the Department of Veterans Affairs, in particular the home in Minneapolis. We'd like to zero in on that. And first off, we'll start with the Department of Corrections, and I believe they have a presentation that they'd like to give. And then as we finish with that, maybe we'll just have a word or two about the Northeast Correctional. Is it yours? Northeast Correctional Facilities up in the Northeast. So welcome. And is it Deputy Commissioner Carlson? Would you like to start, or who is going to start?
Mr. Chair, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Welcome. I can start with the presentation, and good morning, committee members. Last time I was in front of this committee, I was talking about the efficacy of treatment and the impact that it has on recidivism. Today, we are addressing some capital needs, and we are, even in this discussion about capital needs, always focused on our mission. And it is a mission that I think will resonate with you as well as an essential mission of government, and that is to keep our citizens safe and reduce recidivism and reduce the chance of future crime. And very pleased that it's easy for me to sit here because I know that that mission is shared by you. And I think we all were reminded of the importance of that mission after the events in Boston last week. And the knot that was left in my stomach, I think, was a knot that was in your stomach as well. So all of our words are focused on our mission about reducing future crime. And we do that with safe and secure incarceration and effective supervision in the community. I have not had a chance to talk about how good we are in Minnesota with many of you. This particular slide, I think, really demonstrates the efficiency of our correctional system in Minnesota. You can see the states listed above the orange line, and the states below are those states closest in proximity to us in terms of state population. The far right column, I think, is really indicative of how healthy our prison system is in terms of efficiencies. You will note that we only have about 10,000 people in our state prisons. And if we look immediately above Wisconsin, very similar demographics, with more than twice as many people in prison. And I will also tell you, because I know you are very interested in this number, their annual budget, prison budget, is twice that of ours, more than twice. And people look at me and say, how the heck can that be? Wisconsin is just like Minnesota. Wisconsin does not have the benefit of sentencing guidelines. And 30 years ago or so, Minnesota adopted sentencing guidelines, which really led us to a very efficient use of prisons. The guidelines demand that the most serious criminals in our state go to prison. Others are left in the community under community supervision using community resources. Correctional institutions are what we're going to be addressing this morning. And we, even with about 10,000 people incarcerated, we still have, I guess, as a citizen looks at this particular slide, a notion that we have a lot of prisons. Most of those prisons are located in the metro close to the metro region, close to the population centers. Our Moose Lake facility is our furthest north adult facility, and way up in Togo is a juvenile facility that you might know that's called Thistledew. We have some aging structures. Our Moose Lake facility is a recycled state hospital, and our St. Cloud and Stillwater facilities and Red Wing facilities are all approaching and sometimes exceeding 100 years, and we'll show you some pictures of those. We are largely a male-dominated system. About 25% of all male felons go to prison. 75% stay in the community. That's a surprising number for many of you. 10% of women felons stay in the community or go to prison, and the remaining 90% of women felons stay in the community with supervision and treatment. The next slide gives pretty much a high-level overview of the types of people that are in our prisons. And because of sentencing guidelines, you will note that the emphasis is to use prisons for offenders that commit person crimes. Those person crimes are rape, robbery, serious assaults. Recently, we've also expanded our populations, particularly with the felony DWI population, and that is a fairly new population in our prison system. Getting to the subject matter for this morning, the governor and our department support basically three asset capital improvements for our system. Those are the Shakopee perimeter fence, general asset preservation money for our aging facilities, and St. Cloud prison intake, health services, and a loading dock. Sitting to my right is Deputy Commissioner Terry Carlson. To my left is Warden Tracy Belts of the Shakopee Women's Prison. And they will proceed with this presentation, and we will be as efficient as we possibly can be. And I think this presentation will get to the essence of our requests.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. If you could give your name for the record, please.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Belts. I'm warden at the Shakopee Correctional Facility. We have a request for $5.187 million to construct a perimeter fence around Minnesota Correctional Facility Shakopee. As you all know, we are the only female prison in the state of Minnesota, meaning that we house all custody-level offenders. We need a fence to meet our goals of protecting public safety, reducing the risk of escape, intrusion, contraband, all the while maintaining a non-intrusive presence within the community. Picture of the fence that we have kind of conceptually designed is behind me. The design demonstrates our recognition that we want to meet the community's needs of fitting in the neighborhood. When Shakopee was constructed back in 1919, you can see that we were surrounded by farmland. When we outgrew the space that we were at in 1919, we constructed the site now where we're located in 1986. As you are familiar, we are sitting in the kind of right in the heart of a neighborhood. Back when we were first constructed, there were no homes around us, so the community kind of grew around us. Today, the institution is several times larger than it was back in 1986. We have really been hovering right around 630 offenders lately. Our capacity, if every single bed was filled, would be 669 offenders. We employ about 275 staff with an annual payroll of $13 million. As you can see, Shakopee's increased risk factors over the years. Our population has changed greatly since 1986. Back in 86, we had 86 offenders. Today, we sit, like I said, right around 630. Back in 86, we had 19 murderers. Today, we are housing 95. And in 86, we had 9 sex offenders. Today, there are 28 that reside at Shakopee. This slide depicts approximate location of the prison to schools, a church. You can see there's a softball field. And Kitty Corner, right across the street from us, is an elementary school. As I noted, this prison is right in the heart of a neighborhood. We want to maintain a non-intrusive presence within that location, all the while maintaining our need for a safe and secure facility. I don't know of any other woman's prison in the state of Minnesota that, or excuse me, in the nation that houses the custody level offenders that we do that do not have a secure perimeter. Here are a few more slides that just depict again our location and a proximity of the neighborhood. And I've talked a little bit about keeping people in, but it's not just about that, it's about keeping people out as well. Since 2007, we have 27 documented intrusions, and that can be anything from kids coming on grounds to people not knowing where they're at, thinking it's a community campus, to people that purposefully know what they're there for, and when our staff intervene, they take off running. You know, we've talked about the women that we house there and the crimes that they've committed. Many of them have had volatile domestic violence histories in their lives. And right now, there's nothing to stop somebody from coming on grounds and doing harm to those women other than our staff. We need a fence to deter someone from coming on grounds and doing harm to them, also to protect the orderly operation of our facility.
Warden Bell. Belts, we are privileged to have Senator Pratt join us here, and I believe that's in your district.
It is, Senator Stumpf, and I authored the bill that went through judiciary for this. I visited the fence, and as you can see, we're protected by an ominous hedge that goes along one of our primary roads. As I mentioned in judiciary, our hedge doesn't even have thorns, so it's not very protective. But you know, this is a project that, as Warden Belts mentioned, is really about staving off an incident before it occurs. We've got very violent criminals that are being held in this facility, and I think they've done a good job of designing a perimeter that blends in well with the community. And as I was speaking to some folks just yesterday about it, it almost reminds me of the fence around St. Kate's as you drive up here, as well as using technology to help secure it so that it doesn't have to be as ominous and as imposing and as you would normally think a prison fence would be.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. One of the pictures that I believe it was the previous one where you had people exercising or walking outside without, were they going from one building to another? I believe on page 7. Yep, that photo there. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like we've been talking about this fence for a very long time. Back when we did all the methamphetamine work, that was a big issue about them coming, folks coming onto the grounds and making some deals. And how long has this request been in the works? And has there been any work on a fence, or is there any money that's been set aside?
Warden Bells, you probably. No, you've given a number of tours. I know I've been down there, and I think most of the members of the Capital Investment Committee have been there. So it's been a number of years, I think, hasn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it's been a number of years. We've had several meetings to try to find a happy medium between meeting our needs of having a secure perimeter as well as the community needs that we fit in with the neighborhood. You know, as you can see by the pictures that we have here, it's not your traditional prison fence that we would be constructing. It would be a little bit more decorative in nature, all the while it would keep people out and keep people in. You know, we'd have a deterrent detection system on the inside that would meet our needs for detecting somebody that might be coming over or trying to leave. So we've been attempting to do this for several years.
Okay. Senator Rosen, I think the time factor probably wasn't entirely on the part of the legislature. I think it has been an issue that has taken some time to kind of work through with the neighbors and possibly the city. Senator Pratt, I'm not sure if you can kind of recollect exactly how the process took place, but I think we're at a point now where there's pretty much an agreement. Most parties are in agreement on this.
Most parties are in agreement. There are still a few people in the community that are concerned that a fence would hurt their property values. They've lived by this facility for a long time, and they don't see the problems and concerns that Warden Belts' staff has prevented. They just know that they've been safe since 1986, and there's no reason to think of it. In fact, they still refer to the prison as the women's reformatory. I won't say that there's 100% community buy-in, but I think, you know, that we continue the education process. And somebody showed me a draft of what 12-foot cement walls would look like. Well, that's not what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about something that will blend into the community, preserve property values, and yet provide the security that we need.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pratt answered one of my questions, which had to do with communities' wishes and the thoughts of the community about this fence. I do have one other question, though, about the fence. Can you tell me, the picture you have here has the estimated cost of $5.187 million, and this is the fence that would blend with the community. If there were a traditional fence, while it might not meet the aesthetic needs and wishes of the community and might be less appealing, I'm just wondering what the cost difference is.
The last numbers that Gordon I have, does. The last number that I had on that is that a typical traditional fence would be right around $500 a linear foot.
Versus
the $1,500 that we have. And
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, that's a close enough estimate, so basically it's three times the cost. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo what Senator Rosen and Pratt are talking here. You know, folks, this should almost be one of our priorities. This has been around a long time, and Senator Pratt talks about the training and doing this and that with the neighborhood. I think it's almost to the point now where if we don't do something and somebody does walk off or somebody does walk in with the wrong amount of contraband and you have a you have a homicide and you can prove that that contraband comes from somebody simply walking to the hedge or walking through the hedge, not to mention a bag of dope that's been probably coming to the hedge and being distributed inside, or potentially could be. I'm not saying that's happening, but the potential there is just unbelievable. And for somebody to think that we're housing very serious felons, and you can see now the escalation in the more serious offenders that you're putting in here. You have more folks that are charged with and convicted with murder than ever before, and it's almost irresponsible getting to the point. So I would really. I'm certainly not there working in a facility, but coming from that era of state public safety, know what it is to contain these people, and I know women certainly are different when it comes to containing men. They are different. I mean, I was on a study group that went on for some time with regards to why these people don't walk off more often, why they don't take off more often. And when they do, we know exactly where to go get them. You go to home to get them because there's trouble at home. But the amount of trouble they could get into just walking off, going in between there and home and checking on their children because they couldn't get them on the phone or they think somebody's there victimizing their children at home, it just puts, I would think, the state of Minnesota in a horrible liability. So I would speak very, very in favor of getting this thing finally done.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigts, and those are good points. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Warden, or maybe Senator Pratt can answer this question, and I apologize. I know I've asked this in sessions past, but I don't remember the answer. You know, I came off of City Council myself, and clearly what's going on around that facility is certainly in part the responsibility of the city in zoning and in allowing single-family homes to go in and allow a school to be built and allow a church to go in. Have you had any conversations with the city in terms of are they willing to pick up a portion of the fence at all in terms of I realize they probably take the stance, well, it's a state facility, but in the same regard, the local elected officials zoned those single-family homes where I think probably some of your opposition or concern is coming from. Has anybody ever asked them to pay for part of it?
Warden Bells.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have gained a letter of support from the City Council to build a fence, but we have not had the discussion about them paying for a fence. And I believe your statement about it's the state's responsibility to do so would probably be of like mind with the mayor and City Council.
Senator Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, does the Department of Corrections think it's reasonable to ask the city to pay for a third of it or 25% of it? Or?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have viewed the city and their contribution to this project in terms of political support. We have not had the boldness to ask them for financial support, and it's probably I can probably predict what that response would be, but it may they certainly support us in terms of police and emergency response support, and in fact I was at the governor's Shakopee meeting. I had a conversation with two Shakopee police officers prior to the event, and we were talking about the fence, and they referenced several incidents and were supportive of the fence. But in terms of, and we appreciate that community's support of us. We had the explosion the other day down there, and they certainly were in concert with us and what we were doing. So those kinds of services we see as their contribution.
Senator Peterson, generally, and I'm, like I say, the new chair here. We're also privileged to have the former chair of the Capital Investment Committee, Senator Senjum. But it's my understanding that for state facilities that we generally don't have a match component to it like we do with higher ed or local projects or regional type projects. I mean, you certainly could institute something, but Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think what Senator Peterson says is a very valid point, that they did zone and they did allow for the expansion in this area, and there is a certain amount of responsibility that they should at least be recognized for. Whether they take that financial responsibility is one thing, but they did allow for this expansion around here that has, of course, precipitated this fence and had, you know, made the rules of engagement different in that area now. So I do think it's a very valid point that he brings out.
Senator Peterson.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rosen. I appreciate that support. I think Senator Stumpf, I agree with you. I think it's a state facility, but the thing that is different about this project, they're asking Minnesotans to pay for a fence that's three times the cost of a regular fence, and that's being done because of the neighborhood and because of the churches and because of the schools. If this was a conventional facility along Highway 10 like we have in St. Cloud, we wouldn't be asking for a fence that costs $1,500 a foot, although a three-foot thick granite wall certainly is more than although that was built with that was built by the inmates rather than somebody else, but certainly costs more. But that's my thought process, and my reasoning is that the community is asking Minnesotans to pay for a fence that's significantly more than what we might normally be doing. So.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think some of it goes back to the history, Senator Peterson and Senator Rosen, where this facility was built in 1919. There was a much different population. When the new facility was built in 1986, we had somewhere just north of 200 inmates in the facility, and the violence level of those inmates was much different than we see today. And so I think part of it is that we're using our facility much different than we were when the agreements with the community were drafted 28 years ago already. And so the needs have changed. And so I wouldn't necessarily put it on the zoning of the city as much as just the fact that the facility, the use of the facility has changed over time. And we're housing three times as many inmates as originally planned.
Good point. Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with the committee members in general that we need to make this secure. There does need to be a fence. But I am concerned about the increased cost because of it being in the neighborhood. And the one I'm looking at page 5, and one of the things we talked about was the increased risk factor. So I just want to talk about these numbers a minute. But I do believe there needs to be a fence there, regardless of the numbers. But it looks to me like the population has increased sevenfold, if I am looking at this graph correctly. And so while there are significantly more offenders in that prison, I'm not convinced by looking at this graph that actually the severity of offenses has really changed from what it was in 1986, because it looks like the number of murderers has gone up by fivefold and the sex offenders a little more than three times. So it looks to me like the overall ratio of level of offenses has stayed the same, but the issue we're talking about here is that there are seven times as many inmates. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair. Warden,
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do have some information on just along with the risk factors associated with this, the escapes and intrusions, and if you'd like, I can get into some of that information for you that can kind of help round the picture a little bit. We do have more people that are committing more serious crimes that are housed in our facility. Along with that, we also have the risk of escape. And since 1995, we've had seven offenders escape. Another 18 have planned to escape. We have five offenders that are currently housed out of state because they either plan to escape or attempted to escape. And I currently have two women in segregation that had planned to escape or attempted to escape. They don't have enough time to be sent out of state. So the reality is, while we haven't had an escape for a while, it continues to be an issue for us to manage. Our staff do an extraordinary job of finding out information that is out there from other offenders and mitigating these issues before they become reality for us. So along with the crime, there is also that as a risk factor. The other is the risk of intrusion. We talked a little bit about that. Since 2007, we've had 28 documented cases of intrusions. The most recent was an issue that we had about a month ago where there was a gentleman on grounds, 3 o'clock in the morning. He was drunk, passed out. One of our staff came upon him, found him there. We called the local police department, EMTs. They removed him from the property. Within 8 hours, he was back on grounds. We activated, again, our ICS emergency response. We had the police come. Again, he was detained and taken off grounds. The thing that sticks in my head about that incident is that I had a staff that came to me that I have worked with her for years. She had come to me, and she was as white as a ghost. And she said, you know, when I activated ICS, I knew that was the guy from the night before. And all I could think about is kind of like leading the lambs to slaughter. My friends are responding, and I, you know, why is he back here? Is he mad? Does he have a weapon? In fact, he had come because he had lost his cell phone and his glasses, and he was looking for that. But the reality is, given the world that we live in now, the factor of somebody coming on grounds and doing harm to somebody is very, very, very real for us. And that was just one incident that I can recall in recent times that's been an issue.
Excuse me, Senator Scalzi.
And I have a question. I'm looking at two different kinds of fences here, and I'm not sure what the department is proposing. On page 4, when we're looking at the perimeter security fence, $5.187 million. And first of all, I guess I should say thank you for your accommodating the capital investment committees in the past for the tours. It's been very helpful as we look at this today. But I'm thinking of Senator Nelson's comment about the $1,500 a foot. When I look on page 4, I see a fence that looks like a really burly fence, and I can see why that would cost that that amount. But then I look on page 9, and I see examples of the proposed fence design as compared with St. Catharines University. That looks to me uneducated in this type of cost analysis, that looks to me like it would be a lot less expensive than the one that we see on page 4, which has the curved top and very much more substantial metal uprights. So what is the department proposing, and are there maybe two different types of proposals that we could be looking at here that would still be a fence, still fit the neighbors? One might be less money than the other.
And excuse me, and Commissioner or Warden, could you just briefly touch on the? Is there any additional security besides the fence, such as a warning system or whatever, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, first to the representations in the PowerPoint, we have yet to go through the final design process, and Bill Montgomery, our architect, grounds manager, is with us today, and he speaks eloquently about the design. And these, we always hesitate to put representations out because people focus on those, as you just did. And we presented those more as a flavor of what the fence will look like, not the actual design. And actually, I would probably like Bill to maybe address the committee about some of those design factors, because I think you, it has certainly come up in the committee this morning that those are important to you.
Sure, that would be great. And as he comes to the desk, members, we do have some coffee back here if anyone's interested.
And he, Mr. Chair, he will also address the enhancements for other security.
Please give your name for the record.
My name is Bill Montgomery, and I'm the Capital Resource Administrator for the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair and Senators, regarding the design of the fence, this fence, as you have stated before, has gone through a number of iterations of design throughout the years. I think this original report was done in 2005, if I recall the original pre-design report that we had done. And that at that time, actually, the fence was looking to be a little bit more expensive than that. We've worked with the architect that's doing the design and the project, the professional estimators on this, to try to get this down to the point where it's acceptable to the community, yet is a design that's acceptable to us in terms of security. What we've come up with is, and we use St. Catharines fence as a design, just image for people to think of how it's going to be constructed, mainly representing the piers, and then in the case of St. Catharines, that's actually wrought iron. But in this case here, it's powder-coated steel. It's a better product for what we're using here. So that affects the difference between that design. We believe that the curved tops on the fence that are represented in the current design that we're pressing forward with is the best solution for us in terms of keeping people out and keeping people in. There's an additional video detection system inside the fence that monitors the entire perimeter of the fence and alerts us if there's any movement out there so that then we can respond with our teams. But the cost of the fence, like I say, is we've been very careful in terms of identifying what is extra and what's not necessary, and we believe we've come up with the best representation. The fact that we could put up a cyclone fence around this thing for a lot cheaper, that's true. We could do that, but that's something that I don't believe would be and has not been proven to be acceptable to the community.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Mr. Montgomery, maybe you can comment with regards to male prisons. When they put up fences, do they not put up two fences with the ability to drive in between the perimeter fences?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's correct. The other systems have a dual fence system with a kind of a no man's land between those things. And that, again, is part of our system of keeping prisoners from getting in or getting out by having this double system. We feel that this system is not acceptable in this location. And we actually did, at one time, get a price for that. But that's actually a little less expensive if you look at it. But it's again, it's that compromise between putting up a fence that is probably what we really would need in a male prison, but versus when it's in a situation in a neighborhood that has other needs and also a fence that still works for us. This fence will work for us too. That's the important thing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment with regards to my colleague. Senator Nelson, with the growth here that we've been doubling in these particular crimes, and I think just a simple note, and we still don't have a fence around it. I think her point was is the growth is still continuing with the amount of numbers that are there, but we continue to have this potential liability. It is a state function, state run area. And I can't even imagine the scenario that the commissioner had given us for me to go and tell my constituents, who I think they have a pretty good idea what jail is. And I'll tell you one thing that I do know, that building jails or correctional facilities is probably the most unpopular thing to do with public dollars, especially in light of the need for schools and whatnot, as you well know. But to tell them that they had a prisoner in Shakopee actually stumble drunk onto the prison grounds and was found. And they would say, well, how in the world could that happen? How could they possibly get on the prison grounds? Well, they don't have a fence around the state prison where they house murderers. They would say, seriously? Really? You don't? This is really long overdue.
Thank you. Senator Sensible.
Sir, thank you. And perhaps to the warden or maybe better yet to the facilities individual, I'm sorry. I don't have your name, but
Mr. Montgomery.
I'm just trying to understand, you know, the mathematics to this. We've got a little over $5 million proposed at $15 a foot, and you know, then I take my calculator out, and that's about 346,000 feet or so of fencing. And frankly, Senator Thomasoni and I divided that by miles, and it gets to be about 65 miles. Now, that's clearly you don't have 65 miles around this prison. There must be a lot more into this proposal than just the fence that we're paying for. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum.
Mr. Montgomery.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum. You're correct that there is a lot more. As prescribed by the Department of Administration, we put together a pre-design report for this project, and that pre-design report produces a capital budget request. And I'm sorry we don't have a copy up here to give you, but it outlines the cost other than just the construction cost of the fence. And those costs includes the design fees for the architect and engineers that are going to be working on that. It also includes project management that the Department of Administration does for us. It includes some testing that isn't included in the construction cost, which is, again, completed through the Department of Administration. We have hazardous, there's a contingency that we put in there, too, that's usually about 5 or 6% of the construction cost. And at this point, that contingency is usually a little higher because at the pre-design level, you have not actually designed this fence. You're still at a level where you need to have a higher contingency for uncertainties that you know that you're going to discover in the design. For instance, we may discover out there that the soils are so bad that we have to do some additional corrections at the foundations for the piers or for the fence. That would be an example of something.
Mr. Montgomery, I was under the assumption that it was $1,500 per foot.
Oh, $1,500. I'm sorry. Okay, I got to divide my zeros now. All right. All right.
About $15 a foot.
Oh, yeah. $1,500.
All right. I'm sorry. Coming around.
Hey, Senator Pappas.
But, Mr. Chair, can
Oops,
I just...
Senator Senjum.
Have you know, and not to belabor this, but when I'm down there, if I want a little, you know, just, again, thinking about the security... At a far lesser cost, you conceivably, it may not be popular, but you could use the building as part of the wall. In other words, as I kind of generally think of it, you could fence between the buildings, still have a fairly large pod area in the middle, and have your security. And what I'm getting at, you know, the broader perimeter of your land out there, you got a lot of land. And that's a lot of $1,500 bills to go all the way around that. Is it conceivable? Have you ever thought of just fencing internally, so to speak, providing the security, keeping your vibration detectors, your cameras, et cetera, guarding the perimeter and keeping the riffraff off, so to speak, but handling it that way?
Warden Bells.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we've talked about that, and there are costs associated with linking the buildings together. You would have to harden up the windows, any kind of egresses. We have emergency exits that would, in the event of a fire or an emergency, the offenders would then have to egress on the outside of the secure perimeter. There's secured... needs for the roof and so on and so forth where we have any kind of egress or escape hatches out the top. The other issue is bringing the fence in that close to the buildings. That allows people that want to do something maybe with regard to contraband get up close and personal to where they want to drop it off or have it be. So it actually, while it seems, I mean, we've even walked through the exercise, while it seems like it might be feasible, there's huge costs associated with it that increase the it doesn't make it feasible or probably as secure as we would like it to be.
And that's fine. Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
It's my understanding that for inmates who attempt to escape or escape, the penalties are very severe. So it seems to me that this proposal really is more to keep intruders out than to, you know, because you have fairly limited numbers of inmates that have attempted to escape. I just wanted to clarify if that's really more the issue is keeping intruders out.
Warden Bells.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it really is around both of those issues, as well as just the contraband and keeping contraband away from the facility. Contraband can be easily dropped right now. If you can't get that close or if you can't get on grounds, it's much harder to drop contraband. So it is about the intrusions, it's about the escapes, but also just trying to prohibit contraband from being found on grounds. And we have. We found drugs on grounds and alcohol and so on and so forth. So they do, that's an issue that we deal with as well.
Okay. Maybe we can go on. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Could I just ask one more question of the commissioner? What would you envision the cost of a lawsuit for somebody to be able to make grounds, to be able to come on the grounds and commit a an aggressive felony against one of the inmates. What can you even? It's a real hard number for you to come up with, but can you envision what that might cost?
Might depend on
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Commissioner.
Beyond the lawsuit, it would probably cost my job. I think I have lost sleep over this issue. When one of the visits I made to Shakopee was very telling to me. On one side of the street was a group of elementary students walking to school. On the other side of the street was a group of offenders walking back. Nothing between them, absolutely nothing except the hedge. And I, in this day and age of events that nobody can predict, I think we have an obligation to do our best. And I can't imagine the worth of a child. I can't imagine the worth of another citizen and what that value would be. I don't even want to comprehend it.
Thank you. That's fine. Thanks.
Before we move on, do you know, Senator Pratt mentioned that there may be a few that are opposed, but is there any, could you just maybe just touch on the opposition to that, Warden Bells?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, we had several meetings last year during bonding to meet with the neighbors and talk with them. And again, we had gone down to the city council and they gave us a letter of support. The feedback that I got from the neighbors that had traditionally been opposed to the fence, the kind of the typical response was, I'm still not in favor of a fence, but if we're going to have a fence and I think it's going to happen, this is the best scenario for us. Okay. So I think, I don't want to say that everybody's in favor of it, but when we show them what conceptually we're talking about, I think it alleviates some of their concerns.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I remember one comment from a citizen who she told, these were very open public meetings, and she said, everybody believes it's a community college, and we want them to continue to believe it is a community college. Mm-hmm. And it was a statement that I was amazed that a citizen would want to promote a misconception as just a relief factor. That is not the reality of what it is.
And how long would it take to put that fence up, or when would the, if it was funded? Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, if we were to get funding this spring or after or this summer, we would be under construction next year, and it would be completed by the end of 2014, by fall of 2014.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, we would like to proceed fairly quickly because I know there's some very important people in this room that need to be heard as well. And our two other aspects of our presentation are asset preservation and our St. Cloud project. And Deputy Carlson will be taking this presentation along with our warden from St. Cloud, Colin Gao, who's sitting on my left.
Hey, Warden Gao, would you give your name for the record, please?
My name is Colin Gao, and I'm the warden at the St. Cloud Correctional Facility.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Carlson, Deputy Commissioner. I'm going to be doing the asset preservation portion of this presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, we have an identified need of $100 million in asset preservation for our facilities, and this request is for $10 million to protect the investments that have been made in state facilities by making our needed repairs to the infrastructure and building envelopes. With asset preservation money, we address code issues, regulation compliance, OSHA, Department of Health, fire marshals' orders, and so forth. We also use this money for building enhancement projects that improve the safety and security for all, the staff, the offenders, and the public, and also use asset preservation money for energy efficiencies. We operate facilities at 11 sites throughout the state. And many of these buildings, as Commissioner Roy said earlier, are very old and in need of ongoing repairs. Our Red Wing and our St. Cloud facilities are our oldest facilities that were built in 1889. And our Stillwater facility was built in 1914. The Faribault and Moose Lake facilities are converted DHS, regional treatment centers, that we acquired in the late 80s, and these two facilities have been under continual renovation to make the building safer for our prison setting. We use asset preservation money on projects in all facilities throughout the state, and you can see on this slide the type of projects that we use asset preservation money for. Here are just a couple of pictures that show some very visible asset preservation needs. At our Moose Lake facility, there's need for money for tuck pointing, and at the St. Cloud facility, the wall at that facility is in need of very significant critical repairs. And that is going to conclude the asset preservation portion of the request. I'm now going to turn it over to Warden Colin Gow to talk about St. Cloud.
Okay. Just on the asset preservation, before you go on, is the $10 million kind of a amount that... take care of kind of the most immediate needs, or is it something that you feel would be over a period of years? Is that what your request would be, like on an annual basis or biannual basis?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Carlson?
We make our asset preservation funding decisions at our central office. Facilities submit requests to us, and then we look at a scoring matrix to prioritize these requests. We look at life safety and security needs first and foremost. The $10 million we will use for very critical projects. Certainly we can always use more asset preservation money, but we believe that $10 million will meet our immediate needs.
Okay, any other questions on that? If not, Warden Gow, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, our third project is at the St. Cloud facility, which is the intake facility for adult males for the Department of Corrections. This project has several components to it with a total cost of $31.694 million. It includes construction of a new health service unit, remodeling existing space for intake, and constructing a loading dock and warehouse outside the secure perimeter. The project is really about improving safety for staff and offenders at our facility by improving the layout and providing space for the duties that need to be performed there. Due to space constraints, we have inadequate number of holding cells. Our processing areas are undersized. We cannot separate offender movement through our intake area as well as through other areas of the facility. And most of our spaces are not in compliance with building codes to meet the needs of handicapped offenders. The first component of the project is to construct a new health services area. The current space was designed to serve about 600 offenders. We average now 1,000 to 1,020 offenders in the facility. The existing space is inadequate both in size and in configuration. In addition to the routine medical exams and treatments that we do at the facility, we support many other medical procedures for the offenders that we have incarcerated there. The photo behind me shows a security station in an open area in our health services. This area has door controls, switches, and other security equipment that could easily be accessed by offenders. The new space would enclose this and provide security and control, providing a much safer environment both for the staff working there and the offenders that are being treated there. The addition of additional exam rooms would also be increased. We need a larger treatment room. The nurse's station is not adequately sized. We process a significant number of people through our health services area because we are an intake facility. Last quarter, we averaged 1,455 lab workups. We did 1,078 physical exams. Our nurse practitioner examined 651 offenders, and we performed 1,256 dental exams. That's a quarter's worth of activity in that area that is grossly undersized for that volume. The second component of this project after the health services is constructed will be to renovate the existing space for the new intake unit. The existing intake space, like health services, was designed to serve many less offenders than what we serve today. As I said earlier, St. Cloud is the intake facility for adult males. We process approximately 700 offenders in and out of our facility every month. We need to be able to physically and visually separate those incoming and outgoing offenders. The existing hallways, as you can see in this photo, are very narrow. When a disturbance occurs, it's difficult for our staff to respond to get to the area to provide aid to staff or offenders. In addition to the tight quarters, there's not adequate space for all the functions that need to occur in the intake area. Staff use storage closets and other rooms for interviewing and screening because we don't have sufficient office space. Additionally, there's a lack of usable offender shower area for offenders, inadequate space for property that we have to process when we move offenders in and out of the facility. Offenders that arrive at St. Cloud are transported to us by DOC transport bus or sheriff's transport. Many of the offenders are unknown to us when they arrive. We don't know their level of violence. We know very little about them. This portion of the project will include construction of a secure vehicle sally port to give us efficient, secure movement in and out of the facility. Current sally port is unsheltered and allows for the mixing of various transport staff, creating security issues for the St. Cloud staff as well as for county transport officers. First stop for an offender entering our intake area is a holding cell. Generally, you don't place more than 3 to 4 offenders in a single holding cell for safety and security reasons. We have one large holding cell, and it's not uncommon on a busy day for us to have 30 to 35 offenders in that holding cell. Again, if there's an incident, I have to send staff into that holding cell with that number of offenders to provide aid to the offenders that are involved in the incident. So this project would allow us to add additional holding cells, including holding cells that could address needs of the handicapped offenders that we receive at the facility. The third component of this project is the construction of a loading dock and a secure receiving center outside the perimeter. There are extremely large number of benefits to this particular phase of the project. Currently, all delivery trucks must enter the facility through our truck gate. Trucks have to be searched before they enter the facility and again searched on their way out. We process approximately 1,000 trucks through this area. Every time we move one of those trucks through the area, we're opening the gate, closing the gate, searching trucks. It creates the potential for any number of bad things to happen. By building a secure loading dock outside the secure perimeter, we can reduce, we believe, by 90% the number of vehicles that would have to pass through our facility entering the interior perimeter. So it would greatly enhance our security. I will stop at this point and say that is the conclusion of the presentation.
This is a question that probably there isn't anything that you could do, but why was St. Cloud picked for the processing of all male offenders?
Mr. Chair, St. Cloud was picked for processing all male offenders primarily because of its central location. We also planned at the time that we did this to utilize central transport buses to move the larger number of offenders that come to us from the metro counties. So the department is taking on some of the burden of making those transports, but central location was the primary reason.
If you look at where the male inmates are coming from, I would imagine that the high majority of them are coming from the metropolitan area. I mean, they probably come from all over the state, but would the high majority be coming from the metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair, yes. The larger percentage of our incoming inmates do come from the seven-county metro area.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my question originally. But the follow-up I'm asking is, what about in 20 years? I mean, is this still going to be the best place to do this, or would our money be better spent elsewhere where the prisoners are coming from?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, 20 years from now, I hope all prisons are eliminated, but that is just a hope. And we all know that we're going to have miscreants in our communities for a long, long time to come. My desire and my wish, I would eliminate these old facilities. They are worn out. They have exceeded their lifespan significantly. They don't meet modern prison construction standards. But I would be a fool to sit here and suggest that to this committee, knowing the cost of new prisons. And I think the chair suggested earlier that, or senator, that proposing use of public funds for prison expansion is not a popular thing. So we are really, and I hate to say this, but duct tape and bailing wire on some of these old facilities, and we're doing the best we possibly can, and the locations are not ideal. Shakopee prison location is god-awful. It would be a terrible day for me to sit here and say that that prison needs to be in Shakopee. It's a ridiculous location for a prison in a residential neighborhood. It would never, ever happen again. But we're left with old facilities. We're left with poor locations. We're just doing the best we possibly can with what resources we have, to tell you the truth.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was going along that lines. Obviously, representing St. Cloud, I knocked on the doors of many of your staff this last summer, and this project was very prevalent. And I would say, of all those folks I talked to, the staff believes that rather than spending, what's the request on this? I think it was $34 million or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, rather than spending $34 million, you know, what can we build a new prison for across the street? If we can do that for $100 million and have a state-of-the-art facility, are we down? Are we going to spend a third of that on this and keep an older building? What do you respond? What's your response to that type of question from your staff?
Commissioner?
That, it, as I just mentioned, continually crosses my mind. At what point in time does this state say enough is enough in keeping these old state hospitals going and keeping these old facilities going? But the climate and the needs of this state are so significant in other areas besides corrections. Citizens are demanding much of us these days, and again, here in a few more years, I would love to be sitting at this table and suggesting that we have three new facilities in the state of Minnesota. But I know the difficulties that previous building projects have had, and it's taken decades to get those things accomplished, and wish I could do it.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I mean, this prison is over 120 years old, actually, the one in St. Cloud, if I recall correctly. And I should just get the amount. I don't know the exact amount.
Mr. Chair and members, the amount for this project is $31.694 million.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, and kind of segueing into that, what do we do with the old facilities we have? And I know the commissioner probably has thought about this. In fact, has been asked about this. And we have a newer facility in the state built in the 1990s in Appleton, very state-of-the-art prison sitting empty right now. I believe it's empty. And it's a prison where we felt was good enough to put up to, I think, 900 and some of our prisoners in there at one time because of overpopulation in our other facilities. Has there been any thought of purchasing that facility due to the fact that it is only built in the 90s versus early 1900s, and moving sentenced prisoners out to an area that has had prisoners at one time, I think, for a period of well over 10 years. Has there been any thought of that, or do you know what happens to be the price of that? Is it up for sale, or?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it has had an interesting history, and it is currently owned by Corrections Corporation of America, and that is a private for-profit prison company, and they took ownership 4 or 5 years ago. Luckily, in the slide I eliminated from this presentation was population projections for the Department of Corrections. Luckily, we do not have a line that's rising as rapidly as other states. We have pretty good population controls right now. It's just that, and a stable population. So I think, and I've said this very publicly, I think our population is not the concern that we're going to be good for about 6 years. We will be growing 100 to 200 offenders per year, and we should be able to accommodate that, especially considering that we have over 2,000 vacant jail beds around the state, and we contract with local sheriffs for some of our short-term offenders. Appleton Prison is currently seeking a federal mission in that prison. They are... They operate several federal contract prisons around the country, and they have an interest in doing that in Appleton. So there is some interest in that community for that. So we currently do not have a price on that. It's not for sale. And, again, our population needs are not demanding a new additional building. We just need better existing buildings for our existing population.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just had one last comment. I want to take a second and recognize the work that Commissioner Gao is doing, particularly in your masonry training program at the St. Cloud Prison. This is a case where an inmate can get in prison, get a number of apprenticeship hours, and essentially walk out of prison and get a job at $22 to $23 an hour the very next week. And that's the type of training that's going on at St. Cloud. And I wanted to recognize you for that work and your staff member, Mr. Kilinowski, that runs that program. So,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think along that line of thinking for us as a capital investment committee, it was the same thing. If many times we all know this in the old houses, you fix up an old one, and you got to look at the cost-benefit ratio. But the only thing that I'm getting here is fixing up an old one, not a comparison of a newer building like Senator Ingebrigtsen talked about, or a total no. I have nothing to compare it to for that same population. So we're kind of being asked to be making a decision here in a vacuum, and I find that rather difficult.
I don't know how many members on the committee have gone up there. But it's hard to give a realistic vision of what actually the conditions up there actually are. I mean, it really does need to have a redo. I feel sorry for those people that work in that intake. When you said a large holding cell, it's not that large for the amount of people or inmates that are coming in, and so I'm not sure our decision here is. I think it's pretty well shaped by the fact that we have to probably, do the upgrades and kind of go down that road versus a new prison. Because it's a thing to do. I mean, we got the rest of the facility up there. And the one thing that you didn't touch on, though, is that there's a possibility that the request that you have which is, I think it was 30-some million dollars, could be phased, and we didn't talk about that. The possibility of having part of it funded and then move on to the next phase, which is, could you just touch on that for...
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair. We have looked at phasing this project. We can break it into two phases. If we did it in phases, phase one would be the construction of the health service area, main corridor addition to that, a chiller building, and the design cost for phase two. So phase one cost would be $18 million. Phase two would include intake, loading dock, and warehouse with a phase two cost of $15 million. And by doing it in phases, we add $1.3 million to the total project cost.
Good. And really, the health services is the most immediate place to start.
Based on the information we have from the people we've worked with, that would be the best way to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Senator Senjum.
And you can keep this short. I'm trying to understand something, and maybe it's been said. Does a state prisoner go initially to St. Cloud, get worked up medically, and then may they then go to Stillwater or Lino or stay in St. Cloud? Or is that the way this kind of works, or do we have these individual health? Obviously, we have to have an individual health service in every prison. I mean, people get sick. But is this also then the kind of the triage for initial intake into the prison system for all inmates, and thus then maybe needing more physicians? I'm really kind of thinking about the physician staffing thing, which is probably really the cost of one of these operations as opposed to the facilities.
Warden Gow.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, St. Cloud being intake, our primary mission is to intake offenders, classify them, assess them, do the medical workups, do a program assessment, make a program plan, and then from St. Cloud we determine which facility they should go to get the programming they need.
That's all I need. Thanks.
And Warden, I believe you have can hold them up to what, 30 days?
Mr. Chair, we can hold them as long as we need to, but because of the fact that we have 350 coming in, we need to move 350 out. The average stay is approximately 45 to 90 days for that assessment process.
All right. Thank you. Anything else that we want to touch on? One other thing that, and I know Warden Belts is gone, but... Oh, she's still here? Okay. The other day, or last week, we had a hearing on the security hospital down in St. Peter. And one of the issues that was covered was the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program. And if you could just touch on the portion of the sex offenders treatment that is in the women's prison as well as the men's prison. I mean... When someone's committed or when someone's sentenced, you have a treatment part of the sex offenders program at Moose Lake, or is that where all of the sex offenders go, or are they all over the system in the state?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Warden, Deputy Commissioner Carlson.
The female sex offenders certainly are housed at the Shakopee facility, and there's programming for them at that location. For the male sex offenders, we have treatment programs for them at the Lino Lakes facility and also our Moose Lake facility. And once they're assessed at St. Cloud through the intake process, the determination of their need and the risk level is assessed, and then we make placement decisions into our treatment programs based on that information, based on their sentencing length, and all of those types of factors.
And are you participating in the discussion on the is it an advisory committee that's going to make recommendations as to the outcome of the sex offenders long-range commitment or non-commitment, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I do sit on that task force, and we obviously have been meeting regularly, and lots of the discussion does revolve around the previous treatment that is offered in our prisons, and then the assessment of risk upon completion of their prison sentence. That is our responsibility as the Department of Corrections. And based on that assessment of risk, we make referrals to the county attorneys for them to make their decision about whether they are going to proceed with a petition for civil commitment. So we do play an important part. Unfortunately, and you mentioned the program in Moose Lake, we have joined with the Department of Human Services, and we have a model program there that hopefully will divert and offenders from that civil commitment process by offering successful treatment in our prisons. Unfortunately, we are only treating about 30% of our sex offenders. We have a tremendous need for treatment beds and other aspects of our proposals. In fact, this afternoon we'll be talking about some funding for additional treatment beds as well. So it's a complicated collaboration, and working with sex offenders is a challenge not only for our department but for the Department of Human Services as well.
And Commissioner, I think it's confusing to us as legislators as to the outcome not only of the recommendations that we were hoping that we would receive, because it does have an impact on the request that both Human Services has in, and also you didn't touch on it, but there was a portion of your request for Lionel Lakes, which isn't, you know, you didn't mention that part, but it does seem like something that you know, it would be nice to know whether there's a treatment program that'll be successful enough that it'll divert some of the sex offenders' long-range commitment, which would lower the state's need for investments in that end of it, and also, if your treatment program is successful, it may encourage some exit of those that you feel have been successfully treated out of the system. And I know it's a difficult subject because it's a kind of an unknown. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo those very same comments. I wouldn't dare ask the commissioner or anybody at the table what the success rate on sex offenders is, because I don't think it's very high. But I will ask. I guess he knows.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, we track recidivism rates for sex offenders very closely. And much to the surprise of many citizens and perhaps people in this room, the recidivism rate generally is about 4%. Sex offenders perform far better than our run-of-the-mill offenders. We've recently completed an actuarial study of those that we release and don't get referred for civil commitment, and we have found that lifetime recidivism for even really serious sex offenders is about 17%. It's a group of offenders that have high impact when they do reoffend and get a lot of attention. It's kind of what we call in the field high stakes, low risk. Because if even one fails, it's a terrible crime.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll finish here. But, you know, that just goes to show, I think, and, you know, my comment earlier about building jails and building correctional facilities or safeguards around them is just a very unpopular thing to do, to spend tax dollars on. And people need to be more educated and understand what goes on in these prisons. And, you know, when they drop them off at the door, the public thinks, okay, they're going to be taken care of, and that's the end of it. And now a whole different bunch of very professional people have to be able to take care of those people and try and get them rehabilitated and keep them safe in the community, keep them safe in the physical block. In fact, I keep talking about liability. There's a liability if you don't have them classified in the same place. If you put sex offenders with somebody who doesn't want to be with sex offenders, you better be able to determine that in an early stage, or you're going to have trouble. And trouble could be death, or could be serious assault. And once again, then the dollar signs start coming up about liability and what it's going to cost us to not have taken care of that person properly. It isn't just like when my dad was sheriff in 1962, you'd just turn the key and you'd go downtown for dinner and just worry about it and bring him back a sandwich. You just don't do that anymore. It's not Barney Fife anymore when it comes to prisoners, and it's changed an awful lot. But I think our system here in Minnesota needs some fixing, and we need to be paying attention to those that we put in these positions. They're doing a great job. MinCorps, I think of ICWC programs. Our Minnesota's answers to the chain gang is working very well, and I think we really need to pay attention to their needs because, again, special folks are taking care of those that we don't want to take care of. And they have to be trained, and they have to have the facility, and we have to make it a safe place, both for the prisoner. Now, that's hard for the public to grasp, but especially those that work with them. So thank you for the presentation.
Thank you for those comments.
Commissioner, one other issue that we visited on a little bit beforehand was the Northeastern Correctional Facility. Could you just comment on who's all involved in that, and what do they do?
Mr. Chair, the Northeast Regional Correction Center is a community corrections facility just north of Duluth. And previous to my work now as commissioner, I was director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections. And that particular facility, I'm aware that they have made a request to this committee as well. And I can speak to questions. I can't speak to the exact need, but having been the director of that agency and my whole career, I know it intimately. And it is, I heard the presentation the other night from them, and that particular facility was once called the St. Louis County Workhouse. It's a 1934 facility. Again, one that's been held together for years and years with county funds. It's a community corrections facility, so we do pass through money through the Department of Corrections as part of the community corrections subsidy. We have most of our big counties in the state of Minnesota are financed with county money and state money. It's a collaboration that has existed for decades. And this particular facility serves 150 male minimum security offenders. Again, it is one that has been cobbled together for years and years, and their request is to meet some infrastructure needs that previous director was not good at getting funds to meet. And it is many offenders that end up there, it's just not a work farm. It's a treatment center. There are sex offenders, chemical dependency. It's an education. Senator Mary Murphy actually was a strong proponent of this facility for many, many years and still is. Some offenders that end up in this facility are those that normally would come to prison, but under the sentencing guidelines, judges have the ability to depart from those, and they keep people locally. And many sex offenders who have prison sentences are not coming to our state prisons but are ending up in facilities like the Northeast Regional Correction Center. So it does serve a state purpose as well as a local purpose.
I think that's the point I wanted to make, is that it actually does save the state of Minnesota by having these people kind of not get into the state prison system. And I also noticed, or actually our council noticed, that one of the main reasons for the request that they have in was to replace the wood-fired boiler, which must be quite old.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
We have some people from St. Louis County if you want to listen to them, but just for the commissioner's advice, Representative Murphy would be upset that you demoted her to a senator just now. And so, but this particular facility has a tremendous recidivism rate that is better than most correctional facilities. In fact, the people that leave there actually leave there with an intention to be assimilated into society as functional citizens, and it works really, really good. And what they're trying to do is just make an investment that actually makes the place better, makes it work better, make it more cost effective. And we started doing some of the reclamation in the last bonding bill with a small grant, and I think this one is like $2.8 million that they're requesting that will end up fixing it up very nicely. So when you have an 83% recidivism rate, that's really, really good. I do not recidivate, that's what I mean.
Right. 83% do not come back or commit a felony, so great. All right, well, thank you. Any other? Oh, Senator Kiffmeyer, you had a question, I believe, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate all of these comments, and I especially like the idea of the Arrowhead, you know, the giving them an opportunity to make a change at the lowest costly level that we can, and because it's huge savings as we go there. In keeping with that, because I also serve on Health and Human Services Committee, this will be my fifth year on that, and I've carried the Minnesota sex offender bills before as well. One of my questions was, you mentioned that you're treating 30% and very good results there as well, and it's been one of those things that I've had a special interest in. And that is, what would be the dollars to treat the other 70%? I just want to get a sense of what we're talking about here.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, kind of the rule of thumb for treatment is for every 100 beds, it's about $1.3 million. So it's just a matter of economy and how we can accommodate. But that is the formula.
And about, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yes, and about how many beds are you thinking then of?
We actually have a handout regarding our level and numbers that I am going to summon for those exact numbers. It is I would love to give you the exact number of our exact need, but again, it's based on that classification system. We treat about 1,900 offenders. We have a treatment need for 1,900, and we serve 30% of that.
That gives me a basis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that we have another presentation. I don't want to take up any more time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Thank you, Commissioner. I hope if you get recommendations out of the task force that you will share those with us. I don't know how much pressure the federal judge is putting on that task force to come up with those recommendations, but I'm sure that that you're all working hard to find better solutions. Well, thank
Chair.
You.
Thank you.
Senator Senjum.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, all these certainly projects are good and worthy, and they all have their attributes. This one here has always caught my fancy, so to speak. I think people go into this and come out of it with you know, a different head on their shoulders in many respects, a work ethic perhaps. Maybe it's so tough they don't want to come back, but I think it's a teaching institution as well as a correctional facility, and I think it does wonderful things.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Thank you,
Commissioner,
and all of you, those that testified. Next, we have the Department of Veterans Affairs. And members, just to, as they come up, just to let you know that we will have another meeting on Monday. It's going to be on Monday at 3 in the afternoon. It'll be in room 318, which is upstairs. And that will be on transportation. So we have Deputy Commissioner Mike Gallucci. And rewired for their presentation.
What's going on?
It's Chairman Redmond, Salary Committee.
Senator.
Pay our public employees a little bit.
I believe members, there's still some coffee back there if you're interested. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. It'll be just a few more minutes.
Moment.
What room did he say? What room did he say, Leroy?
318.
It'll be in 318. Monday at 3 in the afternoon. So hopefully that fits into everybody's schedule.
Oh, yeah.
As we get down closer to the last few weeks, it's somewhat unpredictable.
My apologies, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, good morning. My name is Mike Gallucci. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs in the healthcare. And today I'm proud to discuss with you the governor's recommendation of the bonding bill, which we concur with.
And I know we also have members of in the audience, too, that have come as kind of show their support for the proposal. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, here's my agenda for today. We'll be discussing a brief history, construction requests, asset preservations, and as always, an ability to answer any of your questions that you may have.
And Commissioner, we also have a handout, I believe, that you've provided us with, so that'll be helpful.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members, brief history, if you will indulge me. In fiscal year 10, the Minnesota legislature authorized a master plan that consisted of a three-phase replacement project at the Minneapolis Veterans Home campus. The reason for this three-phase was twofold. First, it was a phase plan that would enable us in Minneapolis to keep the census out of campus, which, as you know, has a constant waiting list. And secondly, the phasing process was the most cost-effective because of the amount of construction necessary and the substantial costs associated with such a large endeavor. At that time, the 2009 study from Gaius Wilson's architect estimated that total funding to be $115.37 million. This project was to result in a remodel of Building 16, which would be a 50-bed domiciliary, a remodel of Building 4 to be a 35-bed adult day center, which was the second of its kind authorized by the federal VA in the nation. Three newly constructed state-of-the-art 100-bed skilled nursing facilities that would be focused on patient and resident-centered care. The remodeling of a centralized pharmacy that would service all five homes across the state, and the construction of distribution tunnels, which would provide the infrastructure upgrades, the ability to transport supplies, equipment, and food across the entire campus. Completion of this project in its entirety would provide MDVA with the ability to become CMS certified and allow for the billing of proceed with revenue capturing in the billing of Medicaid A and B. This project would provide state-of-the-art facilities as well and would represent a significant improvement in the quality of life for the veteran residents that are in the homes. Phase one of this project is complete. This phase focused on Building 19, which provides 100-bed skilled nursing, and the historical renovation of Building 4 to the 35-bed adult day center. The facility was fully occupied in the mid-August of 2012. Some of you were there for the grand opening. And the adult day center opened in May of 2012 and was certified by the VA, both of those sites. Building 19 has just undergone its survey for CMS certification, and we're simply waiting now on the final decision as to whether or not that has passed. We anticipate that to be within the next 4 to 6 weeks. Phase two is fully funded, Mr. Chair. This phase includes the partial demolition of the north end of what is currently the existing Building 17 and the construction of a new 100-bed state-of-the-art skilled nursing facility, as well as the renovation of Building 16, which is, again, the 50-bed domiciliary. We will occupy Building 16 in late June of this year. Phase three of this project was presented to the state during the bonding process of fiscal year 12. MDVA requested $25.4 million at that time and had been had applied for and received the $17.5 million grant from the federal government. This phase included the pre-design, design, and demolition of Building 17 South and the construction of a new 17 South 100-bed state-of-the-art skilled nursing facility. The pre-design, design, and construction of the distribution tunnels and the critical infrastructure to the campus. The final phase of the project was not approved for funding, as you are aware. The state did provide partial consideration as outlined in the bonding bill appropriations for 2012. MDVA is moving forward to utilize these funds as directed by the bill, which is an allocation of $3,050,000 for the design and, or pre-design, design, and demolition of the South Wing and the adjoining facilities that go with that. Additionally, there was a separate funding project for the Central Pharmacy. I believe it was $3.1 million for that within the same bonding bill. Closing project efforts now. The slide presents before you is the current phase of where we stand on the Minneapolis. As I explained, The thing I want you to take away here is that Building 17 currently is on hold. We have completed and will occupy Building 16, but the portion of Phase 2 relative to Building 17 North at the moment is on hold.
Commissioner, could you just comment on... You said that the state portion of 25.4, which was referencing Building 17 or Phase 3, and then as a result, 17.5 federal grant. Now, Has any of that materialized, or is that was the 25.4 state portion not funded?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Yes, the state funding match was not provided. As a result, we requested from the federal VA for a deferment of the 17.5 that they had authorized for us, pending state matching dollars. Okay. Once special session last year concluded and we were not included in that special session, the federal VA turned down our request, and that $17.5 million was returned back to the federal government.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner?
I'd like to provide you, this is a rendering of what we look like at the current moment. Building 17 is the centerpiece here, as you can see, with building 15 and 18, and that represents what would be encompassing phases 2 and 3. This is a rendering here of 17 North. Once it's built, and the yellow and tan coloring is what would be left of Building 17, and that represents, Mr. Chair, what 17 South is, the centerpiece for that renovation and rebuild, I should say. This rendering, Mr. Chair, is just that, a rendering. Pre-design has not happened as of yet for 17 South. This is an earlier rendering of what the campus would or may look like. Even though we have selected architect, we have not moved forward with the 17 South. We're just in the process now of sitting with the architect to determine the positioning there. But I think what I would like the members to take away from here is that this is, in and of itself, a connected and interactive campus. And that was the goal and the objective, I should say, of the initial three-phase program when approved.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you. And on that rendering, as you call it here, this one, where is the parking? Where does it go on? Is that the open space there? It's not marked parking, but is it the open space alongside of it? Or,
Commissioner?
Or is there no need for a whole lot of parking?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. If you'll look, well, I really can't show you. The parking is to the left of 17 North. And we will, part of our concern is to ensure along building nine, all of that is current parking at the moment.
Okay.
Also, I would point out to you that there's other parking areas down by Building 16 and in front of Building 14. So there are various spots close to where visitors would come and employees would park as well.
Oops. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a little question about the funding for 17 North. You said that was on hold. Now, was it 17 South or 17 North that was funded or that you received the federal funds for? Which building did you receive the federal funds for that you had to return?
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, we've received all of the funding for for 17 North, state and federal monies. The 17.5 that I was talking about earlier was for the bonding of 17 South.
Okay.
Commissioner, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Did I hear you say, though, that 17 North was on hold? And I'm wondering why, if all the funding has been allocated.
Commissioner.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you. The reason that 17 North is currently on hold is because it is the centerpiece. 17 North bid came in at $2.1 million over budget during the bidding cycle. We've been working with the Department of Administration as they work through the hot wash of bids to see if they could come within budget. And during that time, the questions raised about the funding for 17 South have blossomed. 17 North is the centerpiece of the master plan. As designed, it is not a self-sustaining building. Its operational integrity is directly linked to the infrastructure of Phase 3, as well as the components of Phase 3, such as the tunnels that would carry the utilities and water, as well as dock and warehouse space. Since the funding of Phase 3 is a question unanswered currently, we consulted with the Department of Administration. It is our joint belief that Building 17 North would be irresponsible from both an operational aspect and in the exercising of what should be our fiduciary responsibility to being fiscally responsible. So given those dynamics of this bonding request, the two agencies agreed that it was prudent to allow the subcontractor bids to expire and to suspend the general contractor and architect's contracts until the status of Phase 3 could be determined. With that joint decision, MDVA formally requested that those bids be expired to the Department of Administration. After this bonding session, if Phase 3 is not successfully funded, then we will be forced to have to stand back and reassess Phase 2 and to be able to determine whether or not how it would need to move forward to be operational.
So, Commissioner, if Phase 3 or 17 South, generally the way, and this is my understanding, obviously it may not be very complete, but my understanding is that on most of these buildings, there's a federal component as well as a state component. And if the bids, or let's say Phase 2 is hinged upon Phase 3, and if Phase 3 state portion is funded, what do you do with Phase 2?
I'm sorry, if you you confused me.
This is really one of the more complicated. It's almost like a word game. But
Mr. Chair, can I just interject?
Sure, Senator Senjum.
We went through this last year too, and I think there was a fair amount of confusion that we had over all these phases and funding streams and I think that in the end maybe we had a complete misunderstanding. I don't know how to rectify it. It's just I would like to ask the commissioner if he could, you know, maybe offline later, put into writing as and we went back, listened to the tapes and so on and so forth, just trying to re-understand where we didn't understand. But perhaps there's some way to put this on a sheet of paper that is just impeccably easy to understand and helpful for the committee, because I don't know, we get these phases and something's off, something's on. It's just really difficult.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Matt, Mr. Chair. And not being on this committee at all before, is this a collaborated effort between the federal government, state of Minnesota? And should there be any wonder why there's confusion? I guess I...
Well, I think, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think it is made much more difficult because of the fact that It is a joint effort between the federal and the state, but we don't know exactly what the federal government will do, and it's even more complicated in the sense that because of sequestration and what the federal government has done, they have ratcheted down the amount of money that they're willing to put in, and I believe it was like $80 million this year for the whole United States, which if we put our state portion in, we may or may not get the federal portion funded. If we do, great. If we don't, then we're back to square one. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair,
shed some light on us, Senators.
I will try to do this very clearly for you. You're correct. Fiscal year 14's money, which is what we're working on in the federal government right now, was reduced from $285 million to $83 million for this country. My queries for fiscal year 15 to them currently is that they do not expect more than $85 million again for the grant programs. With that said, when we talk about why 17 North Phase 2 has to be placed on hold, it is because of the infrastructure complexities that are in Phase 3 that were, for whatever reasons, directed down into the Phase 3 as Phases 1 and 2 were modified and or submitted to meet that budget. I was not here during that time frame, but what I've been able to ascertain is that a lot of that has gone down into that particular phase. So building 17 North would be like building a garage in your backyard that you don't run any electricity or anything to. And that's what we need to be able to accomplish. If I build 17 North, I can't occupy it because there are no methodologies at this time in that scope of work to be able to connect it to the water mains, utilities, be able to deliver food to it. It doesn't have a dock, so I can't deliver supplies. And so those are the complexities of 17 North. The reason that we've asked for the full funding is because of for Phase 3 is specifically because we cannot be guaranteed what we will and will not get from the federal government. Why do I say that? Because if you look at what was before you last year, that total bill was $42 million. You received 17.5 from the federal government, and 17.5 does not represent 65%. And so, therefore, I cannot be guaranteed when I have a reduced dollar grant program that when I come there, they will give me what will represent more than one-third of their annual budget to take care of this country. That's why we asked for $54.1 million.
I could just add to that that, you know, from the state's perspective, in order to allow our dollars, our bonding dollars, to go as far as they would, in, you know, we have probably $3 billion worth of requests, you know, for different projects. If we fully fund a project that's has state and federal, we probably are for sure not going to get the federal funding, even if it's there. Yes.
Mr. Chair, to that point, the only requirement that I have when and if I receive any or all of the state funding is to simply notify in writing that I have state matching dollars. I don't have to tell them how much I've received from you. I only have to acknowledge that I have received state matching dollars. So it will allow us to go ahead, continue along the application process, and if there's money available, they'll give me what they have. If it's not, then we will still be able to stay on point and continue through.
Secrets don't keep very well around here.
I understand.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, we should spend $10 and give it to him, and so he can go ahead and say that. In all honesty, he does have some matching dollars. I mean, it's just amazing when we deal with the federal government. I mean, no different than that, an invasive species. We're going to sit back and wait for their royal hinders to get something done. And when you bring up the word sequestration, all due respect, I watched the news yesterday or day before, and when I had time to watch it, and we're building more tanks. They're going beyond the sequestration. They're overlooking it, and they're building more tanks. My guess is probably three or four of those tanks could not be built. We could build everything we needed in Minnesota. So sequestration thing that gets thrown around is it's actually quite humorous. It's brought out when it's ever needed, but it sure didn't make any difference there when the federal government said we didn't need any more tanks, but we're going to go ahead and build some more because we're going to keep some jobs there. So this is just unconscionable that we're sitting around here waiting for the federal government to make a decision to build something to take care of our veterans that have given so much, and I just think it's shameful. And I applaud Minnesota for moving ahead, but it's so frustrating for us to do that.
Commissioner, was there a reason we did not get the deferment on the $17.5 million? Was it because of the uncertainty at the federal level, or was it more the uncertainty at the state level?
Mr. Chair, the reason we did not get the deferment was because it was the second year of the deferment request.
Okay.
There was apparently an error that was made. I'm not sure if it was a federal or if it was agency error in the applications, well before my time, but there was an error that was made. So the first year we asked for a deferment, and we resubmitted for the full funding or the funding of state matching dollars last year. And as you know, Mr. Chair, I came in right in towards the end of last session, and so that application had already been made. Mm-hmm. And we just simply were waiting to see if funding would come as a result of last session. And then approached for special session, and we were not successful during that time frame. Their deadline is 1 August because they have to clear their books in order to get ready for their fiscal year. And so they took that money. I think they took that money like on the day after special session. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a comment and then also ask a question. And on the sequestration issue, I'm really kind of amazed because I know that was an across-the-board cut. And so why they would do 60% on this grant program doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't quite add up. But on the issue
Senator
of...
Senator Kiffmeyer, I think the traditional federal portion is 60%, isn't it?
65%, Mr.
65%.
Chair.
65%.
No, I meant the total grant dollars available. Went from 285, I have written down, to 83.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Right. Okay.
That doesn't add up. My question for you is, you mentioned on your initial comments that the bid return on phase two here was $2.1 million over budget. And I'm recalling that the Department of Corrections said that if they did it in two phases, it would cost almost $2 million more. And so I'm kind of wondering, if we approved phase three and put this together, if there might not be some efficiencies of bidding and costs that might be helpful to this project overall.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I think that this $54.1 million was, we went back and looked at that process already, worked with the Department of Administration, and not only did we believe that 54.1 is an accurate cost factor, but since we've selected our architect and gone through that process from the pre-design process, they have validated this to be almost within 1% of what we had guessed. I believe they came in at just around $51, $52 million, and they had not yet completed all of their evaluation of what the electrical loop, which was a much smaller amount of money that we forecasted than what we knew was going to be required. So we're confident that those efficiencies are already built in.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just have a follow-up. My question, Commissioner, had more to do if you joined together the Phase 2, which is $42 million total, $33 million without with the federal grant program. If you do those two together at the same time, does that get you any cost savings?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I thank you for your clarification. But frankly, that ship has already sailed. We have received all of the funding already, and until I have state for Phase 2, and until I'm able to receive state funding and federal funding for Phase 3, there's nothing that I can move forward with. There is a need for us to simultaneously do some work. I believe that we will, in effect, if Phase 3 is approved and funding is granted, whether it be in its entirety from the legislature or if it's a joint effort with the federal government, there will be a requirement for us to somewhere along the line start Phase 3, at least in the infrastructure pieces, so that when 17 North Phase 2 finally stands up, all of those infrastructure connections can be made. So the tunnel systems and everything would have to start somewhere close right after, maybe 5-6 months before Phase 2 is totally completed in order for us to realize that efficiency that you're speaking of. But they're still tied to two different phases. Okay.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, I remember, and I think it's important for us to not forget, this was a pretty critical issue a few years ago. Matter of fact, a bit of an embarrassment to the state of Minnesota. And the reason why that's somewhat at bay today is because we have these projects going forward. If that is halted, I don't think such graciousness would continue. It's so easy to forget. And the circumstances for our veterans have not really changed much. I mean, this has been a hope, and that kind of keeps you going for a while. But I think we really need to remember the situation that our veterans are in right now. And matter of fact, the increasing number of veterans who have needs and what is going on, that setting this aside. But I think the efficiency of using Phase 3 is pretty significant. But I think it's really important to remember that circumstance and that situation, and that I think if we move forward, there's that positive piece that goes forward that can help to correct that. If we abort at this time, I think that sends a very, very serious negative message to this particular group.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we have to realize also a political reality here at the Capitol. We're not sure if there's going to be a bonding bill this year. I hear you talk about August 1st, but there is a shortage of votes, from what I understand, to go forward with a bonding bill this year. And so you have to be cognizant of the political reality here at the Capitol this year.
Could I go back to what you mentioned? The money for Phase 2 is there, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, but you said the bids were $2 million over. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So basically, you're short $2 million on phase two, but the rest of the money is there. So if we would move forward, as mentioned, with phase three, and obviously, you know, there's the full funding of phase three is like 54 million or 50 some million. What would be done first on phase three?
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I may, though, make a small correction, if you don't mind. And that is, yes, the bids did come in for 17 North for Phase 2 at $2.1 million over. It was, however, the Department of Administration and their team have worked with the contractor to get that down into budget and GMP. It was during that time frame of them working that the issue of whether or not funding could come for phase two, they got that within budget. It was at that time that the issue of whether or not there would be funding for phase three that raised the issue of us being able to move forward logically with phase two from an operational standpoint. What we did not want to do is build a building that looked nice but was not functional within the campus. And that discussion with the Department of Administration was very, very critical. And they worked very diligently to ensure that we could get within budget. But what we don't realize right now is what the operational impact will be without the funding of the that goes to phase three's infrastructure. To your second question, what would be started first in phase three would be the building of the infrastructure, the tunnels that would feed to phase two and link into the sewer system, water systems, IT configurations, the ability for us to be able to deliver heat and steam, as well as delivery food and supplies.
Commissioner, all the things you need to operate phase two.
Yes, sir.
And then by August 1st or by the end of the year or whatever, the federal government would notify you about what the outcome of the federal participation would be.
For correct? Fiscal year, Mr. Chair, for fiscal year 14, August 1st is the date for the federal government to start slotting life and safety issues, which is what their goal is with this $83 million, is to attempt to do that across the country. And to the good senator's comment of the political environment, we're very sensitive to the political environment. One of the things that we do know is that if you give me the money from the state matching and the federal government, who has already accepted our application for Minneapolis, is unable to fund, they will roll that over. And phase one and two of this project has already been identified and funded from the federal government as a safety and health issue. My anticipation is that it is only logical that they will eventually do the same for phase three. Logic. The question is simply whether they will have the funding, and since it is in fiscal year 14, or will we need to wait to fiscal year 15 rollover? This program is a first-come, first-served program. So if I'm first in line, because the director is not a politician, and he works with a set of rules and requirements, and those rules and requirements are simple. If you have state matching dollars and you come in line first and I have the funding, I will provide you that if you are a priority one. That is our anticipation, and that's why we are pressing, even though this is a non-bonding year, that this would be something that would keep this project on course, on deadline, to be done and completed by 2016.
Thank you. That's a very understandable explanation. So, thank you. Yeah. Senator St. John.
I think he covered it.
Okay.
Need to dwell on
all right.
those thoughts.
Any other information? You know, one question I had toward the back of your handout, Commissioner, there was request that you had for resident lift systems. Are those part of the new construction, or are those part of what you already, you just need these and could put these to use right now? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, two issues with this. There's never a single issue, apparently, with the federal government. The federal government, as they looked at this, they look at these lifts as a life safety matter. As you notice here, this is to put 25% lifts across all of our homes. This is directly tied, because it's a life safety issue, and because the propensity for states apparently is not to really push them all the time, because they are fairly costly. This represents the 35% that we would have to put up to install these 25% across the board. But the key issue that is tied to their rule change is that our failure to be able to do this 25% across state homes will have a negative impact on any applications that are submitted to the state or from the state for grant funding for any other purposes. And I would simply say to the members here, we are very, very much a proponent of these lifts. Not only have they really affected the decrease in residents falling, but they also have had a positive increase or a positive decrease on our workers' compensation. And as a result, we're well below the governor's mandate in reduction simply because we've introduced these in several of our homes already.
Can you just mention the $385,000? Would you basically, if that's what you received, is, and it would, by the way, members, this would not be bonding dollars; they would be general fund dollars. Would you basically put that money to use right away, or do you wait for the federal match, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, we're already sitting on priority one for this, and so all I'm waiting for is the state money in order to get the federal 65% match.
All right. Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen first, and then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you look at these lift systems, do these go in each room, or are they transferable from one room to the next by rail system through the walls or through the doors? There it appears that you can utilize it and then shift it into another room, or are they all just individual room lifts?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, they are unique to the individual's room, but they will allow them to move from their beds to their bathrooms. I almost said latrine. It's that army in me. Sorry. But moving around within their living quarters.
So I guess my question, the track system is such where they could actually go into the next room where the next patient is at. When the one is placed in the bed, can it go through the system through the ceiling and then be utilized in the next room? Is that just unworkable?
Commissioner Moult? I think most of them are just individually in the room, the patient's room.
Correct. The contractor's not designed a rail system to go throughout the entire home process. Though I would say to you that's a kind of unique thought process, but they've not done that. It's strictly designed to be able to assist the resident within his living area to be able to be moved, turned, be able to get up and assist them to get to the bathroom and to shower and then back again.
Thanks. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these Hoyer lifts? And then how many of them will the 385 from the state plus the additional 65% from the feds, how many will that fund?
Well, I would, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Senator, I would say that you're probably looking at 3 to 4 additional lifts in every home. For instance, with the exception, obviously, of Minneapolis, where Minneapolis would, you know, roughly a quarter of their what would be potentially 300 beds, that would be, you know, a little over 75 beds that would have those lifts. In like Fergus Falls, where there's 106 residents, that would represent a quarter of that. So that would represent, you know, 20.
Senator Nelson?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So what percent of our beds now do you think have these lifts? How close are we to that 25%?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have about 10 to 15 total across the state.
Oh,
percent. I'm sorry.
Oh, percent. Okay.
Percent.
Thank you. Thanks,
guys. Hey. Any other information that you'd like to share or any questions that committee members have? I see we're running close to our quitting time. Thank you for the information. I think we have a much better understanding of the process, which is a little more complicated because of the federal intertwined between the federal and the state and what has been done and what hasn't been done. So, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, just two comments. I would say to you that because of the complexity of working federal and state dollars, if I'm ever around when we do another project that's huge like this, I will not be a proponent of phasing. I think it's very complicated for both the legislature, very difficult for the Department of Administration and the agency to monitor and manage. It's a complex program, and it certainly is I appreciate your patience. My last slide is our asset preservation of $3.3 million. As you can see, many of our homes are in really some tough needs of getting some infrastructure corrected and fixed out there. Some of those go from replacing fire and corridor, fire doors, exit doors, to replacing water mains and fixing roofs. And of course, also included in there is on behalf of Deputy Commissioner Worlds, we have a $70,000 request for Little Falls Cemetery and some of the things that need to be done as we work out there and take care of the final resting place for our Minnesota's heroes. Pending your question, sir.
Mr. Chair, I just have a quick question about are there
Senator
any federal dollars that go with this asset preservation?
Commissioner, is there any match, or is this state just total state dollars?
Yeah, as with all asset preservations, this is all state dollars designed to maintain the buildings that we currently have.
Okay. And Commissioner, the number of people, a number of vets that are waiting for a bed in one of the nursing facilities, what was that number?
Currently, that number is approximately 874 across the state, Mr. Chair.
And once the Minneapolis facility is finished, does that lower that much? Or
one of the options that we have is with the old Soldier Home Building 6, which is currently occupied with 91 beds as we moved everybody out of 17 North, we could continue to maintain that as a skilled licensed or skilled nursing facility of 91 beds. The only difference would be that Building 6 would never be a CMS certified because it just the configuration and the setup just will not pass CMS certification. So the answer to your question is we would be able to take another 91 off from that list of those that are waiting to come in.
All right. Senator Nelson.
Just one final question on the number of beds. So looking at all the projects, the three phases then, is that a net increase of 91 beds over these three projects? Or how many bed? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. So Building 19 will have 100 beds. 17 North would have 100 beds. 17 South would be 100 beds. We would have 91 opportunities in Building 6, and then 50 down in Building 16, which is domiciliary. So it would require us to ask the Department of Health for the authorization of licensing 100 beds, but we've already done that groundwork, and we see no issues with that whatsoever between them and the VA. They are aware of this project and knew that we were going to be asking for that authorization.
Thank you.
Commissioner, how many beds in total are we authorized, is the state of Minnesota authorized for?
Mr. Chair, the state of Minnesota is authorized under CFR 38 from the Department of Minnesota or Department of Veterans Affairs for 1,058 beds.
1,058, okay.
And so this would, upon the completion of Phase 3, would leave us with 915 beds occupied or potentially occupied, and a balance of 143-ish, if my math is correct.
Okay. All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen, and then I think we will have to adjourn.
One real quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like public and private hospitals, they have to pay a bed tax. Do you have to pay a bed tax in veterans' homes?
Mr. Chair, just when I thought I needed my finance director, she has abandoned me, but I don't believe I pay a bed tax.
Good. Right.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you very much, all those that have come to lend support, and appreciate your participation, committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next meeting is on Monday at 3 p.m. in room 318, and that'll be on transportation.
This is a great bright time.
The committee is adjourned.